Hi, I'm Molly Wonsall.
And I'm Geoffrey Wonsall.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we've been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
Which is what prompted us to start this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wonsall and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wonsall.
Hello everyone, welcome back. Thank you for listening. Hope the stories don't get too dark.
I was talking to my friend Megan about this. She said that I'm right and that you don't need to say that anymore.
Okay.
Because people who like true crime podcasts don't mind.
Okay. Well,
the true crime fans.
The true crime aficionados.
They're up for the grit.
The grit. Well, I'm always a bit worried because later today I'm doing a speech at the Graham Greene International Festival and I'm talking about the line between true crime and crime fiction. And in fact, it's very blurred. Indeed. And Green himself blurred it in Brighton Rock.
We talked about that.
We did. About
when we did Peaky Blinders.
Which is, I'm going to talk about again because I think it's so interesting.
And then you can tell them, all the people in the audience listen to our podcast.
Well, we
see
hope
if
so.
We can get our listeners up.
We hope so. We encourage more listeners. And we're a very good piece of news this week. My friends at CBS Reality are going to plug the podcasts on their Facebook and Twitter feeds.
Great. Well, hopefully that will help.
Which we think will help a bit. And we're looking at all sorts of other ways to get the listeners up.
Yeah.
I did recommend someone that they listened to it the other day. And they came back and said it was wonderful.
Oh, that's very nice.
Very
We've had
kind,
some really nice emails as well, haven't we?
We have.
Very kind emails from people saying that they're liking what we do. We really appreciate that, by the way. Thank you very much. We read everyone and we feel very grateful.
We do, and I certainly read everyone and we reply to them all as well. One book caught my eye this week. I'm reviewing a new Anne Cleves. Anne Cleves is famous for writing Shetland and Vera.
Both on TV.
Both on television, one on ITV and one on BBC. And she's created a new character. She is a wonderful writer. And she's created a new, rather troubled, gay detective inspector, which I heartily recommend. It's a very good. He's called Matthew Venn. And
what's the name of the book?
The book is called The Long Call, and it's by Anne Cleves. And by way of apology, when I mentioned the new Stephen King a podcast or so ago, I called it The Institution. It was actually called The Institute. And it is still very good.
Okay, thanks for that correction.
Well, shall we begin?
Yes, today we're doing John Cooper, the Bullseye Killer.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's right,
okay.
We are.
Well, let's get going.
John William Cooper, often called the Bullseye Killer, was born on the 3rd of September 1944 in Milford Haven in Wales. He was not a particularly bright boy. He left school at 15, went into various trades, bit of upholstery, carpentry, and then went into the building trade. He also worked on the fields, in the fields as a casual labourer in Pembrokeshire, that beautiful piece of the Welsh coast. It is very, very beautiful too. In 1966, at the age of 22, he married his wife, Patricia. She was the same age as he was, and they'd known each other since they were 12. They had two children, a boy called Adrian, now Andrew, and Teresa. He was a gregarious man, Cooper, and to the outsider, kind of rough and ready, cheerful enough, but he was also a bit of a gambler. He began working at the Pembrokeshire Gulf Oil Refinery as a welder's mate in 1978. But in 1979, Cooper had what you could only describe as an absolute windfall. He won £94,000 in a spot the ball competition.
Wow.
As well as a £4,000 Austin Princess car.
Spot the ball competition?
Yes.
What's that?
Well, you have a picture of a football field, usually the goal.
Yeah.
And you have to put where you think the ball was. They take the ball out of the photograph.
Ah, okay.
And you have to put, you think the ball, so you put a little X.
Ah, okay. And he got it bang on.
He got it right and won £94,000. He was working as a welder's mate. He gave £1,000 each to 10 family members and took his wife on holiday to the United States. He said afterwards, "I don't worry about jealousies. I don't consider me or my wife changed at all. But people's attitude to us has changed." Anyway, he left the factory, contracted himself to a local farmer. But Cooper was not the sharpest knife in the canteen of cutlery, and he quickly ran through the money. He gambled it, drank it.
I mean, it sounds awful to say, but actually prize money like that, if you actually practically think about how much life costs, like that wouldn't last you that long.
No. But I mean, if you win the Euro Millions now, I mean,
yeah, that's
life changing, yeah, isn't it? But £94,000.
You've still got to work. And
yeah. But he, I mean,
unless you made very clever investments.
By the time his son, Andrew, left home in 1982, he was describing his father as a violent, loud, aggressive man. And in 1983, believe it or not, to sustain an extravagant lifestyle, he turned to burglary. He was relentless. He would almost always break in when there was nobody in the house, but not always. He was a frightening figure. He often wore a balaclava and brandished a sawn-off shotgun. He was a big, bulky man anyway. Big, round head. And just before Christmas, on the 22nd of December, 1985, he broke into a house called Scoveston Park near Milford Haven. It was owned by a local wealthy couple, Richard Thomas and his sister Helen. Richard Thomas was not at the house at the time. Cooper thought there was only Helen. After breaking in, he discovered that Helen was there, but all of a sudden, Richard turns up, gets out of the car. Cooper shoots him in the head and the stomach, and eventually tied up Helen, almost certainly having assaulted her in some way, and shot her in the head. He then set fire to the house to cover his tracks. He lived less than a mile away. Originally, when the police arrived at this dreadful scene of two murders, they thought it had been a burglary gone wrong. But Cooper's family rallied round and they gave him an alibi.
But it was a burglary gone wrong.
It was a burglary gone wrong, but they couldn't find the burglar.
Okay.
Because Cooper's family had all rallied round to give him an alibi.
Okay.
History doesn't relate exactly how much money this particular burglary raised, but there had been at least 30 other burglaries, all of which had raised money.
Did he take cash and jewellery and everything?
Whatever he could do, whatever he could. 4 years later, well, three and a bit years later, in May 1989, he appears on the ITV programme Bullseye with Jim Bowen, which is basically a dart game. You throw darts at a board.
Yeah, you won prizes for throwing darts
That's
at a board,
right.
Didn't
except,
you?
Except he didn't win any prizes. He just appeared.
You were in a team of two, weren't you?
Yeah.
I can't remember. It was a sort of game show that was on Saturday at like 6 p.m. It
was
very famous.
Popular.
And it had a theme tune that was like... I'm thinking of the snookering theme tune. And it had a sort of mascot called Bully that walked across the screen.
A bullseye.
Yeah.
Well, when he appeared, and I've looked at the video of his appearance, he was arrogant, posing, and to some extent conveyed the fact that he thought he could get away with anything and do anything, which to some extent was confirmed by the fact that no one had approached, although the police had interviewed Cooper, no one had come to put their hand on his collar. He was, as far as anyone was concerned, just a local labourer who'd had a good bit of good luck. And less than 5 weeks later, Peter and Gwenda Dixon were on holiday in Pembrokeshire from their home in Witney in Oxfordshire. Peter was a former RAF flight lieutenant, and his wife Gwenda was a secretary. And they were camping. And there's a very scenic path on the Pembrokeshire coast with absolutely spectacular views over the Irish Sea. And this was their last morning, and they collapsed the tent and let it dry out, and they went set off for what they called their final walk. It was June the 29th. About half a mile from where they'd camped, they entered a wooded area and were accosted by none other than John Cooper, brandishing a shotgun. He made Peter Dixon give him his PIN number and his bank card. And again, history does not precisely relate. He shot Gwenda Dixon and Peter Dixon in the face. He left, and this gives you some indication, he left their bodies tied up in a ravine on the right-hand side of the coastal path, and Gwenda's body was naked from the waist down. Cooper then used the bank card to withdraw £300 from Peter Dixon's account. Nobody missed the Dixons for 2 days until finally their son Tim asked the police to investigate. And in early July, the 5th of July, their bodies were found. 6,000 people were interviewed, but no one was able to identify Cooper. When questioned about he'd stolen a wedding ring from Peter Dixon,
and when he just took £300.
Yeah, well, he went to go to an ATM.
I know, it doesn't really seem worth it.
No, I you can say that a lot about John William Cooper. You can seldom understand what on earth he was thinking.
You know why you'd kill two people for £300.
Well, people have been killed for less.
I know, but...
It is. Anyway, he'd stolen a wedding ring, and when the police asked where he'd got it, he said it was his. And once again, the family supported him. So now, John Cooper has got away with two double murders. He's still committing burglary. No one particularly draws attention to him until one day in March 1996, a good 7 years after the Dixons had met their death. Five local teenagers are walking through the fields near Milford Haven when all of a sudden they're confronted by John Cooper wearing a balaclava and brandishing a shotgun. They were clearly terrified. He takes one of the 16-year-old girls away and rapes her at knife point. He then sexually assaults a 15-year-old. And finally, demands money from the rest of the group. Why they didn't run, I think he probably told them.
He probably was threatening them.
Threatened them. He fired the shotgun in the air as a warning shot as he left.
So he didn't take money from them?
Not very much. May have been a few quid,
so
literally.
His motive's changing.
His motive all along was violence, really. Mm. There are very few... I'm glad to say very few Welsh serial killers. The only other one that immediately occurs to me is Peter Moore, who lived in North Wales and owned, known as the Man in Black, who also incidentally killed four people. Once again, Cooper gets off scot-free, even though Crime Watch run a special on the Dixon murders and get 400 calls. No one identifies John Cooper. He always, you know, he was still robbing, still burglaring. He would usually target single females in houses and attack during the evening, wearing a balaclava and carrying his said sawn-off shotgun. In 1998, he committed another armed burglary. He held up a teacher called Sheila Clark with a shotgun in her home in Sardis in Pembrokeshire. He tied her up, but she struggled free and pushed an alarm panic button that she'd had installed in her house. Cooper fled. But soon afterwards, he obviously could describe him, Cooper. Soon afterwards, Cooper was arrested for this robbery and for a string of others. And when his house was searched, they found over 500 keys from various houses in the cesspit, some of which fitted the doors of the houses he'd attacked. And buried under a duck run, a small duck pen for ducks, the police also found another shotgun, carefully preserved in oil and rags. Cooper was charged. And on the 10th of December 1998, he was jailed for 16 years for armed robbery and 30 other burglaries.
No murder charge.
No murder charge. None. Because he'd used a sawn-off shotgun and attacked women who were at home alone, he was considered of interest in the Dixon and Scoverston Park. But no one connected it to him, and Cooper refused to make any sort of statement at all. Indeed, he went to jail, as we know. And in 2006, Difford Powys Police launched a cold case inquiry into the two double murders, called Operation Ottawa, as well as the rape and sexual assault on the teenagers in Milford Haven. They spent years going through cataloguing material. Also, indeed, at one point in 2008, Cooper was taken to a police station in Ammanford, where he was questioned for 4 days about the double murders. The police asked their forensic service to conduct further examinations of Cooper. But in January 2009, John Cooper was released from prison after serving 10 years for burglary and armed robbery.
Oh my goodness.
And his wife, Patricia, died shortly afterwards.
Of natural causes, I hope.
It was, yes. But a clever police officer found the bullseye footage of him appearing on television and compared it to the artist's impression that the teacher from Sardis had given the police, and found it an almost identical match. In a way, although it's terrible to say it, in a way Cooper's bravado, his braggadocio in appearing on television was in the end
to be his downfall. Good.
Eventually, in April and May, he's been released in January, February. Sorry, in January 2009 he's released. But in April and May, more forensic evidence is unearthed. Better forensic testing, better science, better technology. And they were looking for fibre matches, but they discovered a spot of blood belonging to Peter Dixon in a pair of shorts that Cooper wore. Clearly suggested the shorts were Peter Dixon's, and they were taken from his rucksack after Cooper had killed him and Gwenda. And Cooper had kept the shorts, clearly as a trophy.
Mm. Like the keys.
Yeah. It was found, blood DNA belonging to Dixon was found on the breech end of the gun and on the barrel of the gun. They hadn't been able to establish that before, but clearly it was literally in his face. It blew his face away. And there were fibre matches, particularly from gloves. So he was linked to the two double murders, the rape, sexual assault, and the robbery of the teenagers. And on the 13th of May 2009, he'd been free for 4 months. He was arrested on suspicion of the 1980s murders and the sexual assault. In his car, a rope, gloves and ordnance survey map of parts of Pembrokeshire were found. Even when faced with all this forensic evidence, Cooper utterly refused to admit his guilt. Got nothing to do with me. You'll have to prove it. But he did admit, though he didn't realise the significance of the admission, that the shorts did belong to him.
Okay.
Where clearly they didn't belong to him, and they were actually Peter Dixon's. On the 21st of March 2010, Cooper's trial is supposed to begin at Swansea Court, Crown Court. It was postponed until October, and then to the 21st of March 2011. He was facing the charges, two double murders, rape, sexual assault, etc. The trial lasted 9 weeks, and Cooper steadfastly throughout...
Denied everything.
Denied everything. He pleaded, of course, not guilty. The jury took 3 days to come to a verdict. But on the 26th of May 2011, and remember, he'd committed these double murders back in the 80s, he was found guilty on all charges and received a whole life term of imprisonment. He naturally enough appealed. Oh, he would, wouldn't he? But I'm pleased to say, I'm delighted to say, that in November 2012, his appeal was turned down by the Court of Appeal in London. He has since been diagnosed as an outright psychopath. I'm not in any doubt that he was. But he did escape justice for darn near 20 years.
Indeed. Committed so many more crimes because he was out as well.
No,
I know he didn't kill anyone,
not that
but
we know.
He burgled all the people still.
Well, in the period between January and May, when he was finally arrested in 2009, he didn't have a great deal of time to commit many more burglaries.
No, but I meant in the time that he committed the murders before he went to prison for the burglary. He did more burglary.
He does more burglary, yes. I mean, the police only charged him with a notional 30.
Hmm.
I mean, there were probably 60. It might have been 150.
How are there 500 keys?
Well, exactly. Yeah, certainly an awful lot of keys. But you have to ask yourself about Cooper. He was well known in the community. It's not a big place, that bit of Pembrokeshire.
How did he get away with it?
How did he get away with it? One ruse he used was to hide his balaclava and shotgun in hedges in the area, which he used as a sort of safe. He used to put his kind of rape kit or his...
You're right, though, because those small communities tend to... Yeah.
The only thing I can suggest, and I'm not attributing anything to anyone, but I can't believe that someone wasn't at least suspicious of Cooper. I mean, he'd had all that money from Spot the Ball.
Maybe people were scared of him.
Maybe. But it's interesting that Crime Watch didn't turn up anybody, and that's an anonymous tip. When finally Peter Moore, the North Wales serial murderer, was caught when the police set up an anonymous tip line for gays. And it was anonymous gay who rang up and said, I've been assaulted by that man, and I'll tell you where his house is.
Oh, that was good.
So, but this case I often find fascinating because... I mean, I talk about hiding in plain sight.
Yeah. And also...
I mean, it's not...
It's one thing for a burglary to go wrong and to murder the people, but then to just change up to just waiting in the forest for two unsuspecting walkers.
No.
For £300.
It's indicative of bloodlust.
What is it just that after he shot those people in the house, he was like, oh, actually, I prefer... Yeah, for violence to...
I think there are two things that go... perhaps less than often said about Cooper. One was that it was clearly a sexual motive to a lot of these crimes.
Yeah.
It's no accident that two of the victims were women, nor is it any accident that the rape and sexual assault on the teenagers in Milford Haven. There was a sexual element in Cooper. There's no doubt of that.
Yeah.
And there's also that psychopathic lack of empathy, that colossal disregard for anyone else's life. The only life that matters is the murderer's.
Mm.
And that is extraordinary. But there is another, I find, wonderful parallel to Cooper, because there's a very famous American serial killer called Rodney Alcala, who was always known as the dating game killer, because he went on one of those shows when you were supposed to, you know,
Like blind date,
go out on a date.
Well, nowadays it's called
and the
one with the lights.
And the woman who'd chosen him, in the end, refused to go on a date because he was too creepy.
Oh.
Which was actually very wise of her, because he was in the midst of a sustained killing spree in the late 70s.
While he went on the programme?
Yes. Wow. Oh, yes. Yeah. But I do like it. It's that sense of look at me. Isn't it? I think that's what makes the Bullseye Killer such a good name for him.
Mm.
Look at me. Aren't I clever? I can get away with it. What's more, I've got away with it for 20 years.
Maybe after he did the spot the ball thing, he just thought, that's it, I'm a genius.
Well, I can do anything I want.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Not because of the money, just because imagine if he did actually manage to pinpoint exactly where the ball was.
Yeah, I don't know.
What are the odds to that?
Oh, colossal.
As a ginormous.
Colossal. Yeah, but I suppose it's the ego that gets in the way, isn't it? That there is John Cooper thinking that he'll... Oh, I'm going to go on Bullseye and I'm going to win it. He didn't, actually. It was rather a feeble effort. He couldn't hit the bullseye at all. And he was easily beaten. But it's as if he didn't mind. He loved the notoriety. It was, oh, you know, I want to...
Well, we've talked about that before.
Imagine what he must have been like in the local pub. He must have been absolutely, you know...
Awful.
Terrible.
Braggy.
Bragging, you know... Mm. Swaggering about, flashing the cash, which of course has now been raised by burglary, rather than spot the ball.
Very odd.
I'm not saying for a moment that spot the ball ruined him, but it certainly gave him a taste for a life he couldn't afford as a welder's mate.
Never a good thing.
In the oil refinery.
I didn't know anything about him, so thanks, Dad.
No, it's a very, very interesting case. And... partly also because it's the contradiction between this terribly dark figure, Cooper was clearly a very frightening figure, and the absolute beauty of the Pembrokeshire coastline at that point. I mean, absolutely beautiful. And you have, I think Conan Doyle once said, or had Sherlock Holmes say, there's more evil in the rural retreats than there are in the alleyways of East London. Mm. And I think it's true. And that, and Cooper is a very fine example of that.
That's true.
And he's been, the show, I've done one television on him. He is still protesting his innocence.
Well, he can do that from inside prison.
Now he's 75.
Gosh, well.
And still in jail, and there's no likelihood of him ever leaving, no. I'm pleased to say.
Good. I'm glad to hear it.
But,
thank you very much. There we go, the Bullseye.
It's a very interesting and rather nuanced case, because it proves that cold case reviews can work.
I was thinking that's a good policing. I mean, I know it was tricky because they didn't find anything for so long, but they stuck with it.
Yeah, and all power to Dafydd Powys Police, because it was probably quite an expensive thing to do. They were asking for a lot of new forensic work.
Mm.
And what a good job they did, finally, and tracking down someone who was literally staring them in the face and who they'd interviewed a number of times. All power to that local force.
Very good. Good policing.
Congratulations to them. Now, Mo, what are you doing this coming week?
I am going to the Royal Court to see my client Tom Mothersdale in the Carol Churchill plays. It's press night.
Okay.
And I'm also going to Chichester.
That's a long way to Chichester.
On Friday, such a good night for a press night.
Oh,
what is it? See my client Nathan in Macbeth with John Sim.
John Sims as Macbeth.
John Sim and Dervla Kerwin.
I won't be trekking to Chichester to see that. Crikey. I like the teachers to have done some wonderful things, and they're very, very good. But
well, I like Nathan, so that's the important part.
But it's an absolute devil to get to. It takes forever on the train.
I know.
It's absolute.
Get back from, I think, is my...
Well, yes, get back from. You can get there, but getting, you know, it's Macbeth as well, not Short, the Scottish play, is it?
No, thanks, Dad. I've got that. It's not necessarily exactly how I would want to spend my Friday evening, but...
No, well...
Needs must.
That needs must. No, I'm not... I don't think I'm...
Would you like to compete with that?
No.
No? I have a screening on Monday too.
Oh, dear.
And a dinner on Thursday, so...
Well, an action-packed week. I, by comparison, have got...
I'm low on time.
Yeah, you're always low on time, Mo. I've got a much duller week by a comparison. But I have a little odd outing or two. But mostly I spend my spare time preparing television interviews and podcasts and reading lots and lots.
That's called work.
And reading lots and lots of novels.
That's called work.
But I suppose it's working. It doesn't really feel like it always. But
well, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, I think the hardest bit of all is having so many murders going round your head.
I get them muddled.
Sometimes I find myself struggling. You know, I get the name wrong, or what was I talking about?
Well, you're only human.
Yeah, and this week I did, this week that's just passed, I did a couple of cases, one British, one American. And the American, I didn't really know, so I had to go right back to the beginning and really bone up. It's a very interesting case, actually. And it's going to be on World's Most Evil Killers, Series 4.
Right.
And he's a man called Daniel Siebert, also known as Daniel Spence, who committed a series of very unpleasant killings indeed in the United States.
Where in the United States?
So let's begin on... let's end on something cheerful.
Oh, well, I mean, that was meant to be the cheerful bit.
Oh, well, it's unfortunately wasn't. Well, it's Betsy's birthday.
It was Betsy's birthday yesterday. She was 6 years old. I'll put a picture of her party on our Instagram.
Lovely.
She looks very relaxed now, though.
What's that in man years?
42.
She's 42 in people years.
Human years.
Crikey. Doesn't seem so no time since she arrived.
I know.
It's wonderful.
I know. Bless her, we're all getting old.
We should say that Betsy goes to lunch with us every Saturday. Yes. And has her own seat.
Yes, and she has to have a special chair.
Yes, so that she can see through.
So
it.
She can look out at everybody.
At everyone, yes.
In the restaurant. All right, Brill, thanks, Dad.
Pleasure.
Oh, thank you to everyone.
Yes, bless you. Thank you.
Thank you to Poppy Damon, our producer. Thank you to Audio Boom for looking after us. Thank you to my friend George, who drew our caricature. My brother Dan, who did our music. My friend Barney, who helped us with the sound. And my friend and colleague Hannah, who helps us with all things podcast.
Yes, thank you. Thank them all most sincerely. They do a wonderful job for us.
And to you, the listeners.
Well, we all say thank you, and I mean it. Thank you for listening, and as I say every time, do be careful out there.